Okay, I think we'll start now. I'm Kath Scanlon from LS London, and I'll be chairing. And it's a pleasure to introduce Tony Travers. He needs no further introduction than his name. He'll talk for about 35 minutes or so, and then we'll have questions and discussion.
Right, thanks, Kath. I must have agreed some time ago to this title called Local Government Resource Review, Incentivising Growth. And I should warn you already, I'm going to say at the end of what I'm about to say, I don't know whether it will incentivise growth. So if anybody is expecting an answer to what the implied question here, go now. So what I would like to do is to begin by stepping back away and looking at this from London's point of view. This is a series of seminars about London, but frankly, everything I'm saying would apply if we were talking about Greater Manchester or any other part of the country or any county and districts anywhere. So although it's about London, it could be about any other part of England. These reforms, I should say, only apply in England. But I want to start by looking at London's economy and public expenditure within it. I've used 2009 and 2010 as a base for all of this because they are the most recent days which is possible to get broadly comparable data. If you look at the scale of London's economy, gross value added, not the same as, but not a million miles from gross domestic product, £274 billion within the overall UK. That's 21.5% of the UK's GVA. It's risen in recent years from 56% above the UK average to 71% above the UK average. What's interesting about these dates, which happen to be the ones that the Office for National Statistics most recent time series provides, is that they are the beginning and the end of the Labour government that was committed over this period to reducing the gap between London and the rest of the United Kingdom. So what happened is that London actually rose from 56% above the UK average to 71% in a period when regional development agencies were created and public policy was precisely the opposite. Now you could say, of course, it might have been worse without the excellent policies pursued, but whatever the consequences of those policies, this is what happened. The Greater South East, London plus the East and the South East, have also pulled away from the UK, though actually within that, the South East has pulled away, but the East didn't. But if you take the three regions together, its GDP has risen further above the UK average over this period than before. London's population in this year was 7.83 million. That means that the GVA, the workplace-based gross value added, was 21.5% of the UK output, whereas the population was 12.6%. So you can see London is a, according to the figures, highly productive place per head of population. Actually, GVA, that 71% was slightly lower than it had been in the previous year, so the slight fell back slightly in 2010, but the evidence suggests it may have pulled away again in 2011, it's too early really to tell, but certainly for 2011. So now the reason I want to talk about the economy is because I now want to look at public expenditure within it. London's identifiable public expenditure is this, these are figures taken from the Treasury, from public expenditure statistical analyses, excellent volume, 79 billion in 2009-10. And of course, that's the so-called identifiable spending. There is about 15% of UK public expenditure that can't be identified and allocated between regions. If you add a pro rata population or expenditure-based share of that, it takes you to around 89 billion. So that 89 billion, if you set it alongside the GVA, it's not quite like you'd like, obviously, but it's the nearest, it's what a number of researchers have done over the years. You can see that public expenditure in London is equivalent to 30% of workplace GVA. it would be a slightly higher percentage of residence-based GVA, but it's about 33%. That compares in the same year, using the same numbers, with the UK average of about 50%. And that means that, and this is true also, I should say, of the southeast, the greater southeast, which also comes out at around that 33%. So public expenditure in London and the greater southeast represents a significantly smaller share of GVA GDP than other regions. And just for comparative purposes, well, I did these numbers yesterday. If you look at the northeast figure, it's 66%, and Northern Ireland 75%, if you're on a like-for-like basis. So what that tells you, if you flip that round, is that the private sector is vastly larger relative to the whole economy in London and the greater southeast than it is in these other regions. And that's important, not for this seminar particularly, but because the public sector is now a declining industry for several years into the future. So if your public sector is 66 or 75% of GDP, it clearly matters more than if it's 33%. And that's why there's been a lot of interest shown in these figures. Now, if we take that, now we're going off into the realms of surprisingly difficult. You might say, well, if we can identify that public expenditure, including an assessment of the unallocated margin, is around 89 billion. How much of that is in the hands of central government and how much in the hands of local government? Well, oddly enough, there is no publication that allows you, there's nothing that makes it possible to say what these figures are. So these figures have to be constructed bottom up and then taken away from the top figure, in effect. So there are reasonable figures for the boroughs, from CIPFA, the Chartered Institute of Public Finance and Accountancy, and elsewhere, and indeed for the GLA, though capital expenditure figures are not as easy to come by or indeed to handle, and certainly housing isn't, as you might imagine, because a lot of these figures are net of income. So for housing, housing comes for London curiously close to a zero in public expenditure, because the revenues brought in from rents come very close to the expenditure on the service, so that oddly appears as a naught in underlying the, not quite as a naught, but virtually as a naught. Anyway, so as we're looking at net public expenditure with fees and charges taken off it. Boroughs broadly 28 billion, the GLA 10, now that's of course the budget, the mayor's budget is 14 billion, but if you take all the fares off, those are the fees and charges, comes down to this net figure. So these are net, as I say. And then if these figures are removed from that figure, which is what I did, but in fact you can infer it from the PISA numbers and it comes to something quite similar to that. So central government departments, which includes the unallocated margin, which of course is covering defence and foreign affairs, but a large amount of which is the NHS or Social Security. Interesting that Social Security is spending as much in London, more or less, as the boroughs, right? So this is, you know, pensions, unemployment benefits, et al. This is broadly how that expenditure figure is made up. So broadly, two-thirds in the hands of central departments, various, one-third in the hands of the GLA and the boroughs. And this is slightly bigger than it would be in other regions, because the GLA is a more powerful authority with more expenditure than your average county council outside London. So that's the 89 billion as split between these three versions of spending authorities. Now, I'm going to get these figures right. Boroughs 28 billion, suddenly it's 25 billion. Anyway, never mind. GLA and borough expenditure added together, according to CIPFA, is about 25 billion, of which revenue spending is 6.2, capital would take it to 10, and the boroughs about 18, 19 billion. Capital about 4 billion, British don't invest much, these were still in the old days, before capital was cut, split roughly 50-50 between the GLA and the boroughs. Revenue spending includes education, and capital excludes housing. So, a broad sense of where the overall figures for spending by the GLA and the boroughs, how they're split between revenue and capital. What's the if we take those revenue figures, 25 billion for the GLA and the boroughs, and say how's that funded apart from grants? Well, 4.3 billion from council tax, that's a local government property tax, the only tax that local government has. For those gamefully writing all this down, it will be put on the LSE London website, and the slides will appear there. 4.3 billion came in from council tax, that's the GLA and the boroughs, mostly the boroughs. Fees and charges, which are netted off, all these figures, 2.5 billion. And the business rate yield was 5.3 billion in 2009-10. That's in brackets because business rate yield is actually collected by the boroughs but paid over to central government. It's not a local tax currently. That's why I'm about to talk to you about a reform to it. So the council tax there, that 4.3 billion, financed about 17% of net revenue expenditure in London in 2009-10. Had the business rate been a local tax, the two together would have funded about 38% of revenue income. Now, as education is in that, education has been now centrally funded for a number of years. So if education were taken out of the spending side, then council tax and business rate gets nearer to, it was certainly a majority of all the funding for local authorities in London. So, if we look at council tax and non-domestic rates in relation to all public expenditure in London, remembering, if we go back to that figure, that total public expenditure was 89 billion. Now, this is the new figure. This is taken from publication of the Corporation of London's, London's place in the UK economy for 2009-10, at that time done by the LSE, by LSE London indeed, now carried on in excellent form by Oxford Economics, came up with similar kind of numbers. This is, if you look at the total amount of taxes paid in London, it's bigger than the total amount of public expenditure. London's a rich place, lots of high income people and higher earning businesses. So the total amount of taxes paid, it's not a precise figure, this is probably, has been estimated to be in the range of 97 to 100 billion. And this is what's led to a talk of a tax export, probably not the right term to use. But if you look at what is raised from London in taxes and what is spent on London by all levels of government, you get a gap of around £10 billion. And that, of course, is then used in other parts of the country to fund services there and more. This will become a much more important issue as when and if Scotland decides to secede from the United Kingdom, because this calculation will then have to be done and the taxes will all have to be attributed, including North Sea oil. Anyway, of that figure, council tax is there 4.3 billion. It would fund about 4.8% of all public expenditure in London, and council tax and business rate together would fund about 10.8% of all London's public expenditure. So these taxes are tiny in relation to the overall level of expenditure in the city. Hard to believe that. Most people think council tax is a very large share of the taxes they pay, because of course it's the most visible tax that most people pay. And in fact, just while we're here, if you look at the council tax, and the business rate as a proportion of the tax those taxes as a proportion of the overall tax figure, they are in fact even smaller. Now, the purpose of why of the seminar today is not really to look at all of that. That's just a bit of background to embed the purpose of what I'm about to talk about, which is how the existing local government funding system works. That's raising the council tax and the business rate, and the grants that are paid to fund local governments beyond that, and how this is about to be reformed. So, local government revenue spending, that's the boroughs and the GLA's revenue spending, is partly funded by a council tax, just talked about that, significantly by grants, some of which are, of course, funded by the business rate recycled via central government, and by fees and charges, which are, to some extent, invisible to everything we're now saying, but they are, they're real, but they are, for accounting purposes, not visible in all these calculations. non-domestic rate collected by councils and pooled, that started in 1990. Prior to 1990, business rate, property tax, like the domestic rate, was a local tax. The two were set by councils. But after 1990, this is Thatcher's government nationalised the system, and thereafter they're collected, as I say, by local government and pooled. Grants are paid in part to achieve high levels of equalisation. In fact, there are two kinds of grants paid to local authorities. Specific grants for a specific function. So education is funded entirely, a school's education, entirely by a specific grant. And the rest of the grants are general grants. General grants are paid to add to local authorities' underlying income, and then the councils are free, along with their council tax, to divvy that up in their budget and spend it on the services for which they have statutory responsibility. Now, equalisation takes account of differences in two things: measured expenditure needs and taxable capacity, or resources as they're sometimes called. So spending needs, this would be how many children there are in the authority, whether they're needy or not, whether you've got large numbers of old people or small numbers, whether they're needy or not, whether there are higher costs of operating in London. All of that is buried in expenditure needs measurements, something that the United Kingdom can justifiably be proud of, having the most sophisticated system of its kind in the world, bar none. Some of its negotiators are sitting in the room. The council tax capacity is a simpler idea. That's simply looking at the underlying council tax base, which of course will be bigger in some authorities than other, notably in many London boroughs, where there are many more high-value properties than in, say, Liverpool or Barnsley in the north of England. And the grant system adjusts for that as well. So if you have large numbers of big properties paying relatively higher council tax, the grant will equalise for that fact compared with the authorities that have many lower value properties. So this grant sounds simple. These are principles that were originally enunciated by the founders of the LSE, Sydney and Beatrice Webb, Sydney in particular, who wrote at this subject a great, some would say over great length. And if you want to see how it all began, it's all there in the library, all of it. Some of you will have read it. And it all began with Sydney Webb's ideas about how to equalise between local authorities, and it's had a profound effect ever since. Now, as I say, England, but separately in Wales and Scotland, have evolved sophisticated equalisation grants that have the purposes I've described. As a sort of an inevitable, logical byproduct of that desire to achieve equalisation of spending needs and particularly tax capacity, allied with the nationalisation of the business rate, we've achieved near full equalisation for assessed differences in spending needs and taxable capacity. It's not, I mean, so if you accept the system in its own terms, that the measurement of needs is fair, no authority accepts that, but that the measurement of needs is fair, and that the measurement of resources is appropriate, then the system works if you spend at the level the government's assuming, fully to equalise for all those differences in needs and resources between individual authorities. It's a highly sophisticated system, enormously social democratic in purpose. However, as a consequence of this system, any increase in the local tax base is equalised away. So, if you are a local authority that builds up the number of houses in your area or the number of business properties, because of the equalisation inherent in the system, then your increased business council tax yield will be equalised away. And because the business rate is now a national tax, in effect, that just goes into national government anyway, and you receive grants through the national equalisation arrangements. So, this excellent equalising system has led to one in which there is no incentive for councils to build up either the council tax base or the business rate base. Last government, Labour government, realised this and introduced an attempt, an experiment, to try to give councils an incentive to build up their business rate base. The Local Authority Business Growth Incentive Scheme easily trips off the tongue even now. LABGI was an attempt to do what I've just described. So it said to local authorities, if you build up your business rate base, then you can keep the product. It said it wasn't that simple. It said, compared with the regional average, and if unless it goes over a threshold, and various other conditions, which meant, undesirably for an incentive system, that when councillors were behaving and deciding whether or not to give planning permission, they couldn't work out in advance whether they'd get any money. And of course, an incentive-based system where you don't know what happens when you make when you behave in a particular way, less likely to work well than one that did. So that has proved an object lesson for the present government. So in fact, the government was well-intended, but the attempt to make the previous system fair made it have the consequences for incentives that I've just described. So, the present government has held a local government resource review. And the local government resource review, and with a lot of paperwork, or at least digital paperwork, on the web about this, is going to allow local authorities to retain their non-domestic rate. So the non-domestic rate, which was nationalised in 1990, is now in future to be retained at the local level again. This will not allow councils to set the rate of the tax, I should stress, but it will allow them to keep the business rate yield. They could change the rate of the tax, as they could change the rate of council tax, but only after holding a referendum about it, which, as you can see, would you like to put up your tax rate, is, you know, not something that most people will vote for. So we're talking here about retaining the yield of the business rate in each authority, given a fixed national rate in the pound, the tax rate. Local government collectively will keep a large portion of their business rate yield, not 100% of it, for reasons I could explain, but a large proportion of the business rate yield. The government's going to hold some of it back. Well, I will mention holding some of it back, because if it didn't hold some of it back, it would allow local government spending collectively to rise above levels that the government has set in the spending review. So it's holding some of the yield back, in effect, to constrain overall local government spending. So councils will collectively keep a large proportion of their business rate yield, and indeed at the local level, keep a large share of their business rate yield. However, this would, other things being equal, have an enormous redistributive effect, because in, predictably, London, there are a number of authorities, most predictably those near here, which have an enormous business rate yield, and there are others elsewhere in London and in other parts of the country which have relatively a very modest business rate yield. So if you suddenly move from a system where they're paying all the business rate into a national pool and they're getting a grant that is fair and distributing and equalising in the way it does, and move over instead to a system where they simply keep all the business rate, for authorities like Westminster and Camden, which are in the Camden side here, the rest of the schools in Westminster, they would produce a very large business rate yield, which added to their council tax would be vastly more than they actually spend. So the government has come up with a system of tariffs and top-ups, a pooling arrangement. So the authorities where they have very large business rate yields relatively will pay a tariff into a pool, and from the pool there will be top-ups for the authorities in the opposite position, broadly finding a way of taking money, a tariff to take money away from Westminster or Camden and give it to Hackney or Lewisham in the London context. Now that will start in the first year of the new system, 1st of April next year, buy your seats now, and as I said, part of the yield, and forget I've said that already. Now, the logic behind this is because what the government wants to do is not just to repatriate the business rate yield, but it wants to give councils an incentive. Because in this new system, they won't just get the business rate repatriated, but as the tax base grows, councils will be allowed to keep it, subject to a qualification I'm about to make. So as the business rate yield grows in an authority, it will be able to keep that growth. Now, there'll be a resetting every few years when they have a revaluation, but there's an incentive there to build up your business rate base. When there is a revaluation, this is complicated, for which I apologise, when there's a revaluation, which there is every 5 years, councils will not keep any underlying growth in an authority's values relative to all other authorities, though they will, as I understand it, be able to keep growth in their own base that's occurred since the previous revaluation, if that makes sense. So any growth between the two revaluations in an authority is kept, but any overall uplift when there's a revaluation in all properties, you don't keep. Now, this is bad for authorities like Westminster, Dun City and Camden, where they have rising rateable values, or have in recent years, within existing properties. So if an area like Westminster or Camden, which doesn't build, hasn't got much new land to build on, sees that overall uplift in its relative rateable values, that will be taken away at the point of revaluation. But an authority such as Tower Hamlets, Newham and Hackney, with lots of land where they're building new, that they will keep. Now, I can't see economically any difference between these two kinds of uplift myself, but others will explain why they are different. But that's the way the system's going to operate. There's also going to be limits for authorities with relatively large business rate bases. So two things are going to happen. At this point, and I've got some nice simple examples in a minute. At the point the new system starts, there will be the tariffs and top-ups to ensure there isn't a big shift of money from the poor to the rich, actually. But thereafter, there will be limits on growth for authorities with relatively large business rate bases. Just to give you a sense of how big a business rate base can be, the city of Westminster, next door, has a business rate yield of £1.5 billion a year, £1.4 billion, okay? Substantially more than any other authority in the country. So if they increase that by 1%, 14 million, on their budget, that's a substantial chunk of growth. Whereas another authority might have a business rate yield of 40 million, where 1% would be, well, 400,000. So you can see that these two authorities are in very, very different starting points. And so the government is going to tax away with a levy this undeserved growth in the authorities with the big tax base authorities. Okay, so for Westminster, the city and Camden, they'll pay a levy on this disproportionate growth. There will also be protection for any authorities with low growth or falling rateable values. Now at this point I ought to pause and say what we're moving towards here is a system with some of the characteristics, in my view, of the national rail fare system, which is an amalgam of a traditional statist or municipal charging system and a bucket shop airline, the two sort of welded together. And what this will do is to put together a social democratic, Websian, fully equalising system and a winner-takes-all system of the kind at least one or two of our colleagues would actually strongly support. And it's sort of bringing together some of the incentives that you'd get from a winner-takes-all system, where growing authorities keep all the tax base, as is true in, say, in America, and keeping many of the good social democratic equalisation underpinnings that lie in our excellent European system. I mean, that's a slight parody, but you get where I'm going here. Now, the current system. I've had to resort to grotesquely simple Janet and John examples to try to make these points. And I'm indebted to Eric Sorensen, who's sitting in the audience here, and Central London Forward, who've I've been doing a little bit of work on this for reasons I'll explain. The current system. Two authorities. This is a simple version of London. Both raise the same amount from council tax. You'd be amazed how many authorities do raise a relatively similar amount from council tax. Currently, much difference, and huge difference in these two authorities in the business rate they generate. In Authority A, it's 1,000. In Authority B, it's 50. In fact, that differential is not as wide as some of them are. But this is a low need authority and that's a high need authority. So authority A gets a small grant, authority B gets a big grant. Remember, this is all going into a national pool, it's invisible to the system. So authority A spends 60 plus 40, 100, and authority B spends 60 plus 140, 200. So it's like a version of Westminster and a version of, say, Lewisham in London terms. Okay, very, very, very simple. Now, how the first year of the new system operates. Now Authority A keeps this whole £1 billion from its excellent business rate, and poor Authority B gets this paltry 50. However, the tariff kicks in and takes minus 960 for Authority A. That leaves them with 100 to spend again. And Authority B is going to get 90 out of the top-up from the tariff that others have paid in, and so their spending is now 60 plus 50 plus 90, 200. Everybody happy. No change. That's how the system operates. Now, of course, I don't want to go into this in detail, the government has said it will revisit the grant in the last year of the old system, and so it might create a sort of hypothetical version of this before starting the next system. That does give a little opportunity for debate and negotiation before we start off the new system. But anyway, that's straightforward. Simply, you could all operate a tariff and top-up system. Very good. Now, what happens in the new system? Remember, this is an incentive system. If an authority now increases its business rate yield, 1% in each case, I'm assuming here. Now, you can see why the wicked government came up with the levy idea. Because Authority A, by a 1% increase from 1,000, has got another £10 million flooding in. It's only spending 100, so that could have allowed its spending to go from 100 to 110. Whereas poor old Authority B only gets 500,000. Their spending would only have gone from 200 to 200.5. So what the government has done is to say, the percentage increase in this will determine, in effect, the percentage increase in that. So if this increases by, if that increases by, let me get this right. Yes, if this increases, this, if this increases, let me get this right. There's a link between, let me get this right. The increase in the business rate as a percentage increases this by a similar percentage. If I looked at it so long, I've forgotten. So spending can only go up by 1%. The business rate yield has gone up here by 1%. Spending can only go up by 1%. And the remainder of the 10 goes into the levy pool. I'm not thinking about this too much. Whereas for this authority, its spending has gone up by its business rate has gone up by 1%. Its spending could go up from 200 to 202, but actually it's only got another 500,000, so it keeps 100%. That's how this works. So that makes, if I now talk to my through, myself through it, so they pay a levy of 9, they don't pay a levy at all. So the percentage increase in the business rate determines the percentage increase in effect of spending. So the rich authority A finds it has to pay a levy, and so the two authorities together see their spending going up to 301. Now, will these incentives work? Well, it's hard to be sure, because there's no evidence from the UK in modern history, or indeed when there was, in effect, tax competition in the past. We did have a system with tax competition, though we didn't describe it as such, in the past. Certainly up to the early 80s, some authorities were able to keep some of their tax growth in the way I'm now describing, and before that, a fair proportion of it. The other thing to bear in mind is if you look at London alone, the yield of the business rate is at 5.3 billion within an economy of, as I said at the very beginning, 274 billion. So the incentive is operating as a margin on that amount within an economy of that size. So it's not as if they're keeping growth in the yield of income tax, let us say, or growth in the yield of value-added tax, which would be a substantially larger amount of money, remembering that those taxes collect five or six times as much as the business rate. So it's only acting on the margin of one tax. Having said that, so the marginal impact on constrained council budgets will, however, be sufficient to be felt. So I think if you're your average local authority, then the potential to grow your budget at a time when the government is constraining it will be a significant incentive, inevitably. And there will be pressures to replace falling what were previously spending that was previously funded by central grant as it's in effect withdrawn, that there will be pressures to replace that money, and that would be greater, I suspect, than the desire to deliver faster economic growth. That is, for most councils, they'll be looking for money to spend much more than they're looking to deliver faster economic growth. Most of them are always quite interested in faster economic growth, but they are definitely going to be driven by the need to build up their budgets. So, unless any of my colleagues can convince me that there is evidence, I'm not sure there is any evidence yet as to how such a system will work. We can come back to that in discussion. Now, just a bit of fun, going back to the charts I was looking at. Councils will be able to operate this system in ways that maximise the business rate yield. So, for example, councils will be allowed to create pooling arrangements of two or more councils to work together. If they work together, as I'll show in a moment, or if they create bilateral agreements, they could actually maximise the yield above what they would otherwise produce. So if we go back to the chart that I stumbled over earlier on, so where we'd established that a 1% increase in the business rate yield allowed Authority A to increase its spending by 1%, and a 1% increase in Authority B's business rate allowed it to increase by 1%, actually could have spent more than this within the rules. And that's what happens. Now, if there's a pool, Authority A and Authority B become, in effect, a single authority for the purposes of the calculations. I'd agree to this, it has all to be signed off, but if they do, I won't go through all the numbers here and now, but take it from me, they can reduce the size of the levy by operating in this way, because they end up with it, in effect, they pool everything and it creates a lower levy. That's how it will work. So the spending would actually go up to 303, not 301.5 in this example, if they have a pool. But if they have bilateral agreements at the margin, so this is a more complicated version of this, if instead of that, Authority A and Authority B say, well, let's move all the development into Authority B, so we're going to have the same overall increase in the business rate yield, but move it across the border into Authority B, then the following happens. Authority A isn't under competitive. You should ignore that. That shouldn't be there. Sorry about that. Ignore that. I'll have to take it off before it goes on the internet. And Authority B, their business rate goes up by the full amount of the increase in the two authorities. But as this is a huge increase to their yield, over 20%, their spending could go up here by 20% or more, from 200 to 240. But actually, it doesn't, so they keep the lot. So if they have a bilateral agreement at the margin, at the boundary, forget those two figures, they can allow the spending now to rise to 310.5. So we have three different versions here, depending on how authorities work together. If they work separately, if they have a pool, and if they work on bilateral agreements at the border. Now, this, of course, is more complicated than it sounds, but near here, if you imagine on the border between the City and Hackney, so the City of London would be in this kind of position and Hackney in that kind of position, then moving a large tower one street north with an agreement by the two boroughs to share the yield will have this effect. I suspect all of this is an accidental byproduct of decisions that people were making for other reasons. So, Complex negotiations and agreements will be needed to agree pooling or bilateral agreements. I think that's for sure. In fact, I think some form of game theory expertise would be needed, because what you need to do would be to convince councillors and developers that pooling and bilateral agreements designed to maximise business rate yield growth could increase the overall yield for London or part of London's yield. And that's undoubtedly true. If authorities work together, they can, in this system, make more money than if they work separately. But to do that, some of them have to agree not to have development in their area and move it to another place, which is not as easy as it sounds. It's easier at the boundaries than it would be in a more concerted and planned way. Talk to the Treasury about this now, and they see this as a stimulus for city-region economic planning. That's what they say. That's what they now say. Not sure they actually thought of that in advance, but there we are. Now, of course, under this new system, developers can be, and indeed occupiers, can be offered business rate reductions and possibly other incentives to move their development. Because part of this partial move to what you might call tax competition will be business rate incentives. Councils will be allowed within state aid rule to offer businesses incentives. And for authorities in some areas, bigger incentives even than that. So it's probably easier to imagine cross-boundary arrangements than an area agreement. But at any boundary between two authorities, there'll be a marginal incentive to move it from one to the other. Every single case, pretty well, except where you've got two authorities where they keep 100%. But in London, there'll be lots of these boundary effects. Now, very briefly, other issues. I haven't talked at all about the council tax so far. Separately from the business rate reform is the new homes bonus. Now, this applies not to the business rate, but to the council tax. So councils will now be allowed to keep yield of their council tax base growth. So this is the other part of local taxation, giving councils now an incentive, which will be a small incentive because council tax per unit and indeed per square foot produces much less money, but it will give councils an incentive to build up their council tax. Now again, the average council tax bill in London is about £2,000. £2,000 per property as an incentive for councils to give planning permission for more housing. Hard to know exactly how that doesn't seem to me like a very powerful incentive, but others may have a view on that. Again, it's just beginning. That's already started. But too early to judge how effective it will be. There are planning reforms, which are sort of partly related to all of this, if you listen to ministers. This will create neighbourhood forums and neighbourhood planning throughout the country, potentially. There'll be lots of neighbourhood fora in London. This is going to add complexity to planning decisions, especially where there are major city centre developments, because the neighbourhood forums will be able to have a view about what other people would see as a metropolitan scale regeneration project. And of course, a separate but important issue for London is that government has said that it is intent on making it possible for a change of use from non-domestic to domestic use without planning permission. Now, this is still up for grabs and negotiation, and central London boroughs, particularly the City and Westminster, have fought hard against this. And it's important in the context of what I'm discussing, because if you take a building like Centrepoint, where there has been some discussion, the big tower at St Giles, Centrepoint currently pays about £3 million a year in business rates. If it became domestic, and the owners have said they might turn it into flats, it probably would only pay about £750,000 a year in council tax. So if lots of businesses in London moved over, as at the moment market conditions would encourage them to, from non-domestic to domestic use, it would erode the business rate very rapidly for some boroughs, potentially. So that's important, an accidental byproduct of another reform. The GLA's response to all of this, interesting indeed. I've talked about the boroughs and borough negotiations and so on so far, but of course the Greater London Authority will keep a share of the business rate growth, and a share as yet unknown, it's still under negotiation. But that gives them a an interest in the incentives that are generated and the yield that is created. And obviously, if they keep part of it, they've got a powerful incentive. They put in extensive evidence to the government over this subject, a de facto bid, really, to take over the control of local government finance in London, I think you'd have to say, very elegantly done. And what's also important is the GLA sets the London plan. Now, if the London plan, which is a strategic planning framework within which the boroughs have to work, if it is the case that development in some boroughs produces much more business rate than others, which will be the case in terms of absolute numbers, then it would be likely that over time the London plan would reform itself to recognise that fact, if they'd any sense anyway it would. Because they'd be keeping a share of a larger number if the development's in some boroughs, not others. And then finally, on this short other issues slide, I don't want to go into this, tax increment financing. For a number of years now, governments and people outside government have been lobbying government to allow the kind of tax increment financing that's common in America, that is, allowing schemes to be developed, usually on derelict land, where an investment is necessary to allow the development to go ahead, but when the development then occurs, the tax yield can be captured in order to pay for the infrastructure that allows the development to go ahead in the first place, if that makes sense. That's sort of pure tax increment financing. Some schemes of that kind are to be allowed, although in the most recent consultative document on all of this, and these reforms, the government is also talking about a wider kind of tax increment financing, which is really capturing some of the business rate growth I've been describing and using it to fund traditional capital projects, which is not really tax increment financing at all, but it's still going to be called it. So what can we conclude from all of this? Well, the first thing, and I haven't really made this point so far, is that the local government resource review and the retention of business rates locally have been put forward by the government as key elements in their growth strategy. In this, the UK, a country where politicians in all major parties are fearful of national economic planning, this, the thing I've been describing, a minor reform to local government finance, is to some extent seen as a major element in the government's plan for growth in Britain. So, we'll see how it works. So that's the one thing to bear in mind. As I said earlier, I think it's impossible to know yet how the new tax incentives will affect boroughs and indeed local authorities' behaviour more generally. I think Nancy made this point to me first. I think it's likely that boroughs with significant growth potential, where there's already growth potential, but where 100% of the growth is retained locally and where there isn't much but a crudely middle-class opposition to growth, are likely to be the ones that can do best out of this kind of system. So in some parts of East London, but also in Manchester and Birmingham, in parts of the cities there where they'll keep 100% of the business rate growth, where there is a propensity to grow, it could work very effectively, I suspect. But in other places, the amount that's kept will be relatively small, and or there will still be passionate opposition to growth anyway, and the amounts kept will be too small to affect growth. So this actually begins to look slightly more the kind of system a Labour government might have come up with than a Conservative government, interestingly. But so boroughs like in London, Newham, Hackney, Southwark and Lambeth will all keep 100% of anything they generate. Many of them have areas of growth very close to the city centre, so it ought to work quite well for them. Just to conclude, this is a modest but interesting reform. Great research potential for students and academics alike. It's absolutely awash with research potential to see whether it has the kind of implications that the government says it will, and whether some of these unintended consequences, you know, the game theory stuff, whether that will work. That will also be good for other parts of academia. But it's not a radical reform of local government finance before George says so. This is not a local income tax. This is not shifting the balance of the way local taxation or taxation in Britain operates. What it is a modest reform which may give some local authorities limited incentives to develop and to grow possibly a bit faster than they otherwise might have been, might have done. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that, Tony. That was really interesting. I've been fascinated and amazed by local government finance in this country ever since I worked 20 years ago for the London Boroughs Association, and I shared an office with Joe, and it was Joe's job to, in those pre-internet days, to pour through enormous volumes of statistics on things like health and education and roads and so on, to find things where London was an outlier, and then make up a plausible argument for the reason why just that statistic should enter into the formulas that determined need and the allocation of resources.
Oh, you mean an objective case?
Oh, yes, sorry, yes, an objective case. Mm. I'll take questions now.
Duncan Barry, University of Westminster. I mean, from the explanation, it seems to be intentional from government that the initial rebasing is to replicate the existing position,
yep.
And only from the change will there actually be some distribution. But I'm interested in terms of, I mean, you said there was no evidence in terms of how this would work, but I remember being a councillor at the time the business rate was centralised, and I'm just interested in whether any research was undertaken then as to whether that actually had a negative impact on economic growth, because there is a precedent for going the other way. So there's one assumption in one direction, there must be some history. I'm also interested in this issue about shifting across borders. I mean, your explanation seems to be that maybe sort of a retrospective justification saying this is good for city regional planning. But I mean, the implication of this is effectively, if two authorities can do a deal, I'm amazed the government can allow them to do so, it is effectively reducing the central government tax take.
Yep.
So I'd have thought it's something the Treasury is nervous about. I mean, it obviously has the possibility of shifting some employment capacity into actually a lower value area, but whether that actually has any impact in terms of access to jobs in Hackney rather than the city. You made a comment about the sort of planning side of a non-residential to residential. If it's a permitted development in terms of if it's an existing property, then it's effectively a permitted development. There's no planning application, there's no planning consent, and therefore you lose the opportunity to negotiate a Section 106. It also removes the local authority's ability to actually determine land use, so you can get residential in all sorts of inappropriate locations. But a fine point is on the London plan. I mean, you're making an assumption that the London plan actually determines where residential and employment growth take place. I mean, although there are land capacity studies for both employment and residential, the London plan by law cannot do any zoning. So it is entirely a local authority determination, even in terms of selective, you know, protected employment sites.
Okay.
What so the London plan could respond, but it's not actually a fundamental framework in terms of determining where growth takes place.
What was the second point? Because I only started writing them when I realised there were four.
Oh, sorry. It's, the second point was this issue about academic research on centralisation. If you took that as the first point, second point is this cross-boundary issue.
Mrs. Thatcher's government did commission research from Cambridge. Christine did it, but certainly it was some of it about the impact. I think, well, I have a vague, it wasn't Christine, it was done at Cambridge, and it was about, they did some work to try to prove in the previous system of local government that, well, the government wanted to show that where rates were very high, rates and rate poundages were very high, business was leaving. And try as they might, the researchers diligently looked and couldn't find any such evidence. So that was that, really. The policy, the reform went ahead anyway. But a lot of work was done in South Yorkshire, as I remember, to look at whether, you know, the very high taxes in some parts of South Yorkshire were leading to businesses to migrate, and although that I agree is the opposite of what we're discussing here, I mean it's the sort of inverse of it. There was no evidence, or virtually no evidence. Is that how you remember it, Christine? I vaguely remember.
Yeah, it was Steve Fothergill.
That's it, Steve Fothergill.
And Fothergill then moved to the Collieries and looked in South Yorkshire.
Right.
Until forward.
Do you want to add something? Yes.
Yeah, I mean, the change was not the mirror image of this.
Well, it's not quite. Well, it was.
No,
that
it was
not
at all.
All right, right, right. Sorry, it was. But I'm trying to say it was research about the impact of high rates and see if there was any disincentive effect on this. This, of course, is an attempt to create a different kind of incentive using the rates, but it's not the same thing as what I was trying to say. It's definitely not the same as this. It's not the same research on the same subject. On the possibility of moving from non-domestic to domestic without having to apply for planning permission, I assume that would mean no Section 106, yes. I mean, I don't know how far this policy is still... Well, I mean, it's still all up for negotiation, but it wouldn't, as far as I can see, lead to any possibilities for Section 106 deals, no. And with the London plan, about which I know much less than everybody else in the room, I guess, my thought was that presumably it would be open to the London plan to shift its priorities for densities of development, wouldn't it? Could it not do that? I mean, I don't have a question, I don't know.
Yeah, but there's no density policy or non-residential in the plan anyway.
Is there not? So could you not use the plan at all to steer development from place to place?
Only indirectly. You just cannot do land use zoning and you have no taxation power.
Right.
You might be able to do something with mayoral infrastructure investment.
Yeah,
you could do it that way, yes. And certainly Crossrail would produce, where you built Crossrail would have a, depending on where you built railway lines.
And differential rates on the mayoral sill levy,
hasn't
that?
Yeah.
But there was the cross-borough issue in terms of is moving your liability cross-borough cheating?
Well, I understand, I don't think the government realised the cross-borough issue existed. I think it's the accidental byproduct of the attempt to capture disproportionate gain. So it was in an attempt to stop boroughs like Westminster and the City having relatively large gains in relation to their budget, just because they had a starting point that was a very big business rate base, they introduced this levy on disproportionate gain, and in doing so accidentally created the cross-borough issue. But it's hard to see how you could stop boroughs negotiating to move a development 100 yards across a street. I just don't see how you could stop that myself. And if it had this effect, then, you know, well, too bad, really. Anybody here like to? Yes, Eric. Eric, then Chris. Oh, sorry, you're in charge. Sorry.
What's interesting about this is that, particularly on the pooling and taking advantage of pooling, is that really Tony's been pushing this. And when he came along to the Central London Borough, the Central London Forum, he said, "Have you looked about pooling, folks?" And they sort of said, "Well, no, not really." And then he said, "Would you like to?" And they said, "Well, give it a go, you know, and we'll see what happens." And so we're now at this quite interesting study. But it is a concept which is particularly applicable to London, because London has this feature of being divided into a large number of relatively small boroughs who are their own local authority, own local resource authority. And yet the pattern of development, as Tony's emphasised, can shift quite easily from one side of the borough to the other. And because we also have the feature that some boroughs are rich, i.e. tariff authorities, and a lot are poor, relatively, i.e. proper authorities, therefore the shifts become very, very significant in terms of the maximisation of retention of business rate yield. The other interesting thing is that none of the submissions that I saw, and I didn't read them all by any means, but was any of this discussed when local authorities went back to government to comment on the proposals which are now incorporated in the Act. They all basically whinged about the complexity of this new system, and it certainly is an interestingly conceptual challenge. And basically said, and then they went on to whinge about council tax rebate costs in particular, which Tony mentioned towards the end. The only, I think it's probably fair to say the Manchester authorities did realise there was something in this, and they put in a submission which is not nearest to the kind of setup that Tony's been describing. The GLA were the only ones to write a positive essay, and they put in 70 pages of submission. But that was basically a bid for mayoral power, and said to dear Eric Pickles, leave it to us, and we'll sort it for you, yours ever, Boris, which is more or less literally what the 70 pages would say. But I think that there is something in this, and certainly when Tony and we're halfway through, so you can't draw any conclusions yet, but I think there's a kind of a reaction to all this of kind of fear and loathing on one hand, and developing enthusiasm on the other, and people see the possibility of some quite interesting resource gains. The key thing is, however, as always, will individual boroughs come together freely around the table and agree, right, that where development will go, and agree the proceeds of that development in terms of the NNDR yield accordingly. And that is going to be probably the single most tricky thing, as it always is.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt that the part of the difficulty in explaining this is that it's, you know, this is reduced to highly simplistic efforts to explain it, and getting it across to a whole council chamber full of councillors is inevitably going to be difficult, I think it's fair to say. And yet, at some level, they need to empower their officers to do deals around moving developments to maximise the yield. That's the problem. And in Greater Manchester, where the 10 Greater Manchester authorities, I think it's fair to say, have the best working arrangement of any group of authorities in the country, certainly any big group, they are more likely to build, they already articulate this kind of willingness for some to forego development so that others get things. There is some evidence of that.
Christine, then,
that's over here.
I'll ask four questions. First one is, who gets the levy? I assume it's the government.
It goes back into the pool,
It goes back into the pool?
Yeah.
It doesn't come out of the pool.
No.
Okay. Secondly, are you allowed to make side payments? I mean, when you've made this agreement, can you pay the other one off?
Good question.
Do you mean, can you transfer the money?
Could you say, you're right, let's all agree about ourselves and we'll put it on this side of the road if you get a compensation for surgery?
Well, it's a risk of giving. If it's a formal pooling arrangement, yes, no question.
Yes.
If it's a bilateral,
right,
then to quote an unnamed director of finance in the best traditions of these things, I'm sure there's a way of doing it. As they always say, I'm sure there's a way of doing it.
Third question is that in the HRA, the ruling has been that pooling cannot happen.
But the consultative
HRA
document explicitly says that pooling, if all the chief executives sign it off, pooling can exist.
Okay.
So it's it would be.
Although the HRA is part of the whole same system, it's been ruled out from the HRA. Sorry, this is the housing side.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to notice that you can actually borrow more than the other guy and therefore you can have something useful. And third, if I was a person from Marl, I might think, of course I don't, but I might think that these places which are really rather got very high business rate are actually the best places to put things. And therefore, if I was interested in growth,
absolutely. I mean, there's no doubt that if we were going for the kind of system where, if the real purpose was to maximise the UK's economic growth, then you'd allow these people to keep it, and a proper winner-takes-all system. That's why I said earlier, this is a grim amalgam of a winner-takes-all system and a sort of Sydney Webb system all bolted together. That's you're absolutely right. And you can see in this the old style Department of the Environment, DCLG, desire to have equalising bolted onto a system that's designed to encourage and incentivise high growth authorities to grow fast. That's what this is. Yeah.
I think possibly, I'm trying to sort of cover history in this respect, but I think this may go back to a paper by Oliver Hartwig some years ago, which pointed out that there were absolutely no financial incentives for local authorities to give planning permission breaks.
Yep.
But they, if anything, were financial disincentives, and there were clearly political disincentives. So I think that sort of got taken up. And then the proposal was, I seem to remember about a year and a half ago, that we got 5 years of the council tax, and that's the new home bonus, and then we got sort of 5 years of the increase in the business rate over and above what was occurring everywhere else.
Mm. That
now,
was lucky.
That was, as I say, proposed about a year and a half ago.
Yeah.
I personally didn't think the incentives were great enough at the time, and I therefore agree with your point about new home bonus. Nothing else, I didn't want to be blamed for the fact that it didn't work because the incentives weren't large enough. But it's actually what I got told at some fringe meeting at Conservative Party Conference a year and a half ago, that it cost a lot of money, but it was okay because we were taking it all back off the councils. But am I right, therefore, in thinking that the new homes bonus has, in terms of 5 years additional council tax, has remained, but this is sort of the complication which has ensued, replacing the sort of the fairly simplistic, you get 5 years additional business rate revenue.
The new homes bonus, which started, I think, in last year, 2010-11, will indeed last for 5 years, and then the first year drops out and the new year comes in and goes forward like that. In the short term, it's been funded out of a grant, but I think the expectation is in the long term, Mike will correct me, I think in the long term, it will be picked up by some of the funding coming out of the tariff. Is it going to come out of the tariff and top up?
The steady state will be about, say, 1.2, 1.5 billion.
Right.
Of that, 250 million the first year is being funded by grant, at least for the spending review period. The rest of it will be taken off the baseline before the funding baseline is set.
So it eats
a lot of other funds.
It eats into the effectively nibbles away at the money in the tariff and top up pool before it becomes a effectively as it becomes a top up, and it takes off both the tariff and the top up in effect. So it will be self financing in the sense that local government will end up paying for the incentive it's giving itself. So it's a redistribution within the system. Several over here.
But this does replace sort of the 5 years business.
Well, the business. Yeah, I mean the new homes bonus will continue as far as we know into the future in that way. This system will come into existence from 2013-14, and the two will then, to some extent, run along side by side. Though logically, there's no reason why they couldn't be operated at some level as a single system. But they will operate as two separately initiated incentive systems, providing the little incentives or the relatively modest incentives they do to both parts of councillors' planning decisions. Correct me if that's.
Sarah Phillips, I've worked in this area for a long time and was called, left it. Before I went mad, was called back recently to some discussions with people in the Treasury. And one thing that you haven't really mentioned is it was made very clear to me about a year ago. I'd worked on the Lyons inquiry, and Treasury and DCLG civil servants made it clear that one of the aims of all this was to get the Secretary of State and central government out of annual discussions about funding. And that at one time, you must have heard this, Tony, about 2 years and a bit ago, they had this idea that the whole thing could be done by regional pools. and that central, because you know, Sarah, we're not going to have it all complicated like you started saying it had to be with the Lyons inquiry. We're going to make this really simple. There's going to be a London pool, there's going to be a Northern pool, in northwest and northeast, a south area pool. And I said, well, how will you fund the north? Because they don't have business rates in the kind of money if you're going to keep the law, which means that you've got an entitlement, particularly to adult social care. And there's an inverse correlation. The more you've got old people needing expensive local services, the less you've got business rates. And they said that was fine because the central list of money from rail and power stations would fund the north, and that DCLG could just get right out of it. And so they very much talked the GLA and others into having a pool and to have regional pools. And then they realised actually that this was not actually going to be work, and also that the public perception of fairness would crack in. So that was an interesting one. I think the other thing that people are really I'm concerned about when I look at it is that economic growth now does not equal business rates meter squared, even as much as it did in 1990. Local authorities want to create jobs often, and sometimes long-term skills, so they might be happy to have the LSE expand over the border into their place, but they won't get business rates because it's a charity. So the idea of what you might want to attract and your long-term growth may not give you business rates income. You may want jobs, and a lot of modern jobs don't need a lot more business rates, and that's a real thing that isn't properly addressed, I don't think. Final big thing, Tony, I've definitely, you mentioned it, but going from business rates, look at Knightsbridge, you go from big business rates on Hyde Park to the most expensive flats in the world. And then it was the Daily Mail of the left-wing rags that said out of 89 flats, only 9 are going to pay council tax. Most of those are going to pay second home reduction because they're owned by companies. So most of the large homes that are created in central London are not paying any council tax whatsoever, which I think is terribly unfair.
Right. Well, it
so
is
you
going
to get anything out of council. Well, no, I mean, centre point at all.
Actually, the system, as we're discussing it here, is kind of presumed there will be growth. And there will be growth somewhere, I'm assuming, but it is all based on the assumption the economy grows. Otherwise, it'll be a matter of who declines least, I think, in the way and the logic of this system. And there's no doubt that one of the things that looking at this system in any detail does hint at is certainly if you talk about the change of use from non-domestic to domestic property, the drop in payment per square foot is fascinating between non-domestic use and domestic use. And indeed, on the same point as same as centre point, there will be buildings in Mayfair which might well pay £100,000 a year as a business property, but which in Westminster will pay £1,400 a year as a council tax venue. So the impact of moving from one use to another can be profound.
A question here and one there.
George.
And George.
I have a request for clarification. Diana, this is from Bartlett in UCL. The request for clarification is two short questions. The request for clarification is you mentioned that there might be an opportunity for local authority to negotiate with developers also on business rates. I wanted to clarify because you said that local authority can only keep the yield and not change the rates. So what type of negotiation would be going on there? The other thing is about neighborhood planning, which is small and might not generate a lot of changes, but it has two characteristics that are important here. First of all, it already goes cross-border, so it doesn't have to be at the border level, and it can set up neighborhood development orders, which are actually permitted development and will probably be used, if these changes applies, or to push local authorities in some directions or others. I don't know, but it's a question. The other thing is about student housing. Because to my understanding, they certainly don't pay transit tax. I'm not sure if they pay a business rate. So I wonder which type of changes we will see when all these come into place and you're looking to change that.
Mercifully, there are people in the room who'll know the answer to the third question, and I don't, so I'll ask them to answer that. The authorities will be able to, the law's been changed to allow authorities to reduce the rate payments. They can't put rates in the pound up, but they will have new powers to reduce rate payments. So they have to do it, as I say, within state aid rules. So they can reduce them somewhat. Neighbourhood planning, I can see how where neighbourhoods cross boundaries, they may well get leverage in this complicated new system. Because developments that are on boundaries or straddle boundaries will produce different amounts of resources for the councils concerned. And so again, it then will come down to a question of how far, and this is inherent in all these neighbourhood planning reforms, how far the neighbourhood planning can convince the council to change behaviour in a way that produces a revenue stream that can in any way be made available to the neighbourhood. Because going back to Alan's point, I mean, some of the figures we're talking about are quite small as incentives. However, if the money were in any way, and I'm not saying this sounds corrupt, as I said, were to be able to be paid to local people in compensation for the detriment they suffered as a result of planning and new development, then you could probably get a lot more through the system. But the question is, how do you, where there is a growth in yield of either business rate or council tax as a result of a development, how is it possible to share the yield, if at all, with people affected locally by the new development? And clearly, in any move forwards in making that easier would encourage more planning, more development than would otherwise have been the case. On the third point about student housing, Mike, I'm sure you can tell the answer. You don't know. There's no answer.
As I understand it, students are exempt. Yeah. So students don't pay council tax.
Which is
now does that also mean, and I think it does, that on student housing nobody pays business rates either?
I thought you only got a 25%.
No. If you register the property as student only, it's an exempt.
It's huge. Leeds Nottingham lost loads overall.
Right, the answer is, it's a very interesting question, and it will clearly have an implication, possibly incentive effects, though nobody knows exactly what they are.
Okay, there,
George.
Hi, sorry, just a few more practical questions. The reset, you said it was five years? I've
yeah.
seen in some documents that it's suggesting 10
years. You're right, it is 10 years. It was going to be five. Used to be, I was conflating the revaluation every 5 years with the reset. So yeah. My fault, you're absolutely right to pick me up on that, yes.
The Secretary of State said that in the consultation and the response document that they will still have the discretion to move resets. And I wondered how much you thought the Secretary of State what reasons might that happen. And also, you said there was no research kind of done into really how local authorities might behave. Is there any kind of research out there on how it might affect business behaviour in terms of if they know they've got a lot more influence over local authorities in terms of moving over boundaries or into areas, how that might affect the relationship between the local business partners and the local authority? And also just the levy, will that only be used to help kind of deprive areas with less yield, or could it be used to fund kind of new burdens, or would that be against government?
As I understand it, the levy will just, like the opposite of the new homes bonus, go back into the tariff and top-up pool. So it'll be like a negative, it'll just put some money into the tariff and top-up pool in a way the new homes bonus effectively takes it out. So that's not really an answer, but it just goes back into the central government in effect. Eric Pickles, the Secretary of State, I think wanted long periods between resets for purposes of stability. On the other hand, the longer those periods are between resets, the greater the possibility that differences in spending needs and other things will build up over time, and it's less easy to take account of any radical shifts in those. So there's a trade-off between stability and the capacity. And I think, though this government probably wouldn't reset it very often, a Labour government, another government might, I think is the answer there. And your question about